For a long time, I've been interested in the spiritual odyssey of Aldous Huxley. Beginning, I suppose, about 1938, Aldous Huxley underwent what some people felt to be a catastrophic change in his literary career. To a large extent, probably, under the influence of Gerald Hurd, he changed from being a brilliant, witty, and highly cynical novelist to a person with a profound interest in the spiritual life and its importance, with strong leanings towards Vedanta and Oriental philosophy in general. It was about that time that he published Eyeless in Gaza and a book on man's contemporary situation called Ends and Means. And thereafter, almost every one of his novels, After Many a Summer Dies the Swan, Time Must Have a Stop, and so on, have been not only novels, but in a certain sense, sermons. And many people have felt that this has spoiled their character as novels. It was about that time, I think, that D.S. Savage published an article in the Sewanee Review, the point of which was that Aldous Huxley hadn't really changed at all. It was a very scathing article, which said that this is a man who fundamentally hates people and hates life. And whereas formerly, what he did was simply to castigate them with his wit in a most entertaining way, but what he's doing now is that in espousing philosophies of life which are essentially negative, he is in another way doing the same thing, that is to say, wishing for the disappearance of the universe into the void, into what Professor Northrop calls the undifferentiated aesthetic continuum, or what Buddhists call sunyata, and the Hindus Brahman. And of course, Mr. Savage, in this critique, made the same mistake that the unwary interpreter of Oriental philosophy always makes, that he takes these symbols literally, and believes that when the void is said, it means literally something like a vast expanse of perfectly infinite jello. But nevertheless, there was at that time, I think, some validity in Mr. Savage's criticism, because at that time, doubtless to some extent under the influence of the Vedanta Society of Southern California, Aldous Huxley's philosophy did lean in the direction of what we call Manichaeism. Manichaeism being a generic name, because it's so typical, of the point of view that the created universe, the universe of matter, the universe of particular things, is an aberration, is a fall from spirituality, and that in the spiritual state there is no particularity, there is only the undifferentiated unity of the divine. And one could see in various ways, for example, in such a book as The Perennial Philosophy, in which Aldous Huxley made a great anthology of writings on the mystical life, one could see that he was leaning to that point of view. But very gradually he began to change. He began to change towards a view of the spiritual life of Oriental philosophy too, in which both worlds were included, in which there was on the one hand the consciousness of the divine ground behind all the plurality of the world, but at the same time a full and intelligent acceptance of the plurality. He ceased more and more and more to be a spiritual escapist. The fulfillment and flowering of this attitude is reflected in his latest book, called Island, and it's just been published by Harper's, and it sells for $5. It says Island, a novel by Aldous Huxley. And this is a bit misleading, because the person who reads this book with the feeling that it's trying to be a novel will be disappointed. I suppose a man who's made a great reputation as a novelist is more or less stuck with the novel form, because this isn't a novel, it's a philosophical and social essay. But it does have the advantage that being put in a fictional form It reads more interestingly than most philosophical and social essays. There's interesting dialogue and asides, descriptions, and so on. But in doing this, Aldous Huxley has undertaken a colossally difficult task. This book is the counterbalance to Brave New World, Brave New World being the picture of things as he was rather afraid they would be, and this being the picture of things as he'd like them to be. And I think there's nothing more difficult than to write a convincing utopia, and there's also nothing more difficult, especially if you have such a wonderful gift for the description of horrible and grotesque things. There's nothing more difficult than to describe the ideal. I've noted this again and again, that, for example, the literary descriptions of hell are always much more interesting than literary descriptions of heaven, and the same thing is largely true in painting. And therefore he's undertaken a terribly difficult job, and all the strikes are against him, because he's describing a utopia that is simply a sitting duck for the critic. It's got all the elements in it which will make some people really furious. It's the description you see of an island somewhere in the Indian Ocean, perhaps near a place like Indonesia, which has been for many years rather inaccessible for having no adequate harbours. And it has on it a population that is primarily Buddhist, people in temperament, I imagine, rather like the Burmese or the Cambodians. And 133 years before the time of the story, it was visited by a Scotch doctor who successfully operated on the wise old Raja. The Scotch doctor and the Raja together then become fast friends and initiate a program for the social reform of the population, and the population being the sort of people that Cambodians and Burmese and so on are, were rather easygoing and, on the whole, very cooperative. And thus the result is a community which now reflects the things in which Aldous Huxley firmly believes as beneficial to humankind. Now, I said that this book is a sitting duck for the critics, because what have we? We have, first of all, the use of consciousness-changing drugs as a constructive pedagogical instrument. We have an entirely new version of the family. The dear old family isn't there anymore, but instead mutual adoption cooperatives, groups of about 20 families that are a voluntary association cooperative, wherein everybody's children can more or less belong to everybody else. If a child, in other words, gets sick of his parents, he can go and live with some other parents for a while that belong to the same cooperative. And, of course, that is attacking a real sacred cow, the family. Then there is, worse still, the practice of tantric sexual exercises. You see, these last two points, the cooperative instead of the family, and the tantric exercises instead of what we ordinarily mistake for sexual love, is based on the Oneida community, in which Aldous Huxley has been interested for some time. That, you know, was a community that was exceedingly prosperous and flourishing, and very one of the few really successful utopias that ever existed in this country. I think it was flourishing in the last century in upstate New York. And, of course, it failed because it was so bitterly attacked by preachers and politicians in the outside world. But here are these factors. And there is also a very interesting description of the idealized educational process in which children are taught not only the three R's, they sort of take a slightly subordinate position to psychological training, to fundamental training in ecology, in various forms of dancing that will be outlets for negative emotions, and so on and so on. It's a very interestingly described program. Now, you see, all these things will be snidely reviewed and commented on. And I'm afraid for that reason that people will not, not enough people will read this extraordinarily intelligent book and let it make them think. As I say, it should not be regarded as a novel. It is a tract, and a very powerful one in some ways. But once again, in a way, its power lies in the contrast that Aldous Huxley makes between what might be and what is. And again, he exercises his astonishing ability to satirize the world as we now have it. And this motif keeps coming up, and he does it very well. When he goes over to describe the ideal, you see, he's not exactly in these respects an original thinker. He's simply adopting a group of ideas on education, sex, the family, politics, and so on, that come from a wide number of sources. And when he wants to make a situation attractive, he doesn't seem to have quite the gift here that he has, as I say, when he wants to describe it as hideous. One of them, I mean, here is Aldous being hideous at his best when he describes two praying mantises copulating as seen by somebody under the influence of one of the mushroom drugs. What he saw now was a pair of inch-long monsters, exquisitely grisly in the act of coupling. Their bluish pallor was barred and veined with pink, and the wings that fluttered continuously like petals in a breeze were shaded at the edges with deepening violet, a mimicry of flowers. But the insect forms were undisguisable, and now even the flowery colours had undergone a change. Those quivering wings were the appendages of two brightly enamelled gadgets in the bargain basement, two little working models of a nightmare, two miniaturized machines for copulation. And now one of the nightmare machines, the female, had turned the small flat head, all mouth and bulging eyes at the end of its long neck, had turned it, and dear God, had begun to devour the head of the male machine. First a purple eye was chewed out, then half the bluish face. What was left of the head fell out onto the ground. Unrestrained by the weight of the eyes and jaws, the severed neck waved wildly. The female machine snapped at the oozing stump, caught it, and while the headless male uninterruptedly kept up its parody of Ares in the arms of Aphrodite, methodically chewed. End of quote. Otherwise, when we're on the positive side, you see, it isn't quite so good, but still good. Here, for example, the old Raja wrote a book for everybody on the island called Notes on What's What. And here is a passage from this book which I think is worth quoting. Nobody needs to go anywhere else. We are all, if we only knew it, already there. If I only knew who in fact I am, I should cease to behave as what I think I am. And if I stopped behaving as what I think I am, I should know who I am. What in fact I am, if only the manichee I think I am would allow me to know it, is the reconciliation of yes and no, lived out in total acceptance, and the blessed experience of not to. In religion, all words are dirty words. Anybody who gets eloquent about Buddha or God or Christ ought to have his mouth washed out with carbolic soap. Because his aspiration to perpetuate only the yes in every pair of opposites can never in the nature of things be realized. And thus the insulated manichee I think I am condemns himself to endlessly repeated frustration, endlessly repeated conflicts with other aspiring and frustrated manichees. Conflicts and frustrations, the theme of all history and almost all biography.
I show you sorrow, said the Buddha realistically. But he also showed the ending of sorrow. Self-knowledge, total acceptance, the blessed experience of not two. The Yogi and the Stoic. Two righteous egos who achieve their very considerable results by pretending systematically to be somebody else. But it is not by pretending to be somebody else, even somebody supremely good and wise, that we can pass from insulated Manicheehood to good being. Good being is knowing who in fact we are, and in order to know who in fact we are, we must first know moment by moment who we think we are, and what this bad habit of thought compels us to feel and do. A moment of clear, complete knowledge of what we think we are, but in fact are not, puts a stop for the moment to the Manichaean charade. If we renew, until they become a continuity, these moments of the knowledge of what we are not, we may find ourselves all of a sudden knowing who in fact we are. End of quote. Of course, anybody can see that that is a mixture of Zen Buddhism, Krishnamurti, so on. But it's very clearly said. And in the same way, a great deal of the book is sort of long lectures to the hero, or let's say the man who tells the story, in which all these interesting ideas are put out, but the style of talking doesn't change very much with each character, unless, of course, the character is not in the role of one of the preachers. For example, one of the most typical and, well, I would say one of the most alive characters in the whole thing is the terrible old Rani, who is a pious fraud and is very convincingly drawn. She reminds me of people I've known. And another thing in the story that is closer to life is the problems of the storyteller himself, the throwbacks to his own past and his terrible childhood. And an interesting account is given of the way a young woman begins to bring him out of his neurosis. Well, all in all, I would say this book represents a kind of culmination of Aldous Huxley's spiritual odyssey. And for that reason, it's very important. It comes as a kind of crown to all the work that he's done. And I see no point in raising objections, really, about its literary form. The point is what it says. And the fascination of somebody who's come full cycle to accept the two worlds, the world of spirit and the world of everyday life, the world of nirvana and the world of samsara, and has accepted both worlds, has really come to the insight which is, say, at the root of Mahayana Buddhism and Hinduism, that the visible material world that we see is not different from the divine world. Look at the same appearances before your eyes. From one point of view, they're separated and in conflict. Look at that self-same scene from another way, and all the things that you formerly called divisions become unities. It looks the same, but it is interpreted and understood quite differently. The two worlds don't conflict with each other. They harmonize. And therefore, to live the life of the spirit does not involve a retreat from the world and a retreat from being involved in its practical concerns. Aldous Huxley has tried
valiantly to put these two things together. That he hasn't been able to succeed perfectly in describing the ideal is true, but isn't it true of us all? It is ever the problem of the artist, trying to make the highest visions that he has convincing to those who've never had them.